This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Has been about to be coming out since like 16, so I'm thinking maybe I'm not alone.
Yeah, it's a complicated case. So how we get here is at one point, Alex Sesney, who we've been talking about, he ends up being a person of interest in this case, like pretty impossibly. And I say that because, so in 2008, he was 38 years old, which, you know, if you just do like quick, dirty math on that, he was born in 1970. The New Bedford Highway killings are this series of crimes that takes place in New Bedford, Massachusetts, but it takes place between March 1988 and April 1989. So it's nine women who are definitely dead, and then the disappearances of two additional women, all from this area. It's really the area that makes them think, oh, this is a serial, and so it's sort of a geographic serial killer. If you look at the 2020 population for that area, they only have about 100,000 people there, but they've got a lot of surrounding area. So we end up with this series of murders has kind of been written off. And several people have tried their hand at putting it together in terms of podcasts and documentaries and books. And I have yet to find a reasonable explanation for what happened there. So I was going to go through it with you and kind of tell you some of the alternatives that people have talked about here. And we could just sort of talk about this a little bit. Now, this is probably two episodes worth of insanity, but I'm going to try and keep it to one. It's a lot of victims who, in my opinion, they were written off for being high-risk victims because they were all either known to be sex workers or having struggles with addiction of some kind, substance abuse of some kind. First of all, let me say, I don't believe that Alex Sesney has anything to do with this. Here's the primary reason. He's an interesting idea as a suspect for serial killings, but that's really it. Like, he's just the idea. The biggest problem is he would be 18 years old and getting away with what is essentially, potentially, possibly, allegedly 11 murders. Now, there is this incident where he's potentially in town during the murders, and the potential is that he's maybe there with a relative, a brother, or a cousin. I've read about this. I don't have the documents to back it up. So that would mean that it's two people doing this, and I could buy that a little more, but I've never seen anything other than this mention of, basically, it's a mention of a speeding ticket. Do you see most people being able to get away with 11 murders between the time they're 18 and 19 years old?
No, I mean, you have to kind of balance it between like how at risk the victims were categorized as, like how much it was looked into. I feel like these cases were looked into, right? I mean, they're 9 out of 11 bodies were found. So I don't feel like it would have been a situation where the reason that the 18-year-old was getting away with them was because, like, nobody tried at all, right?
Right.
So having an investigation been done and having them, the bodies have been recovered, at least part of them, almost all of them, two women remain they're missing and their bodies haven't been located. I don't see an 18-year-old like getting away with that. No. I also think that there's a, which I was not aware of. I think maybe the Jeff Davis 8 started it, but there's sort of this like stigma of clumping things together, for lack of a better word. I'm not saying that that's exactly what happened here, but I feel like anytime cases start just sort of being, you know, like these are the New Bedford Highway murders, right? That's what I've heard them referenced as, I believe.
Yeah, that's what they call them.
And so anytime there starts being like a clump of murders that are all put together, I've seen various information sort of trying to sum up the situation. And I feel like that's one of the first mistakes that gets made, because I feel like it dilutes each case. I don't know if that's the right word, but
yeah, it minimizes each individual case when you lump them under possibly being a serial killer, and you end up with a task force, but I feel like there's no individual investigator per case. And in this case, there's one guy that really is pushing it as both a serial case and like he's sort of made himself in charge. I don't believe New Bedford was prepared resource-wise to investigate these as individual murders. So I think that's sort of why they get lumped together. But it becomes a traffic jam of these unsolved murders that may or may not be related. And the easiest thing to do is to look at it and go, oh, it's a serial killer.
Right. And this gives me a good opportunity to sort of elaborate on what I've said before. I don't feel like if these women were killed by somebody that they know, even if it were to be the same person, I don't necessarily feel like that automatically makes that person a serial killer in the way that I think of a serial killer.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that sometimes there's just asshole murderers who happen to have multiple murders.
Right. And by, you know, the textbook definition, whatever you would consider, you know, the FBI's definition of it, that person would be a serial killer. But in reality, for me and probably you as well, they're just assholes, like you said. And they lose their temper and they're, you know, hanging out with higher risk people who end up being victimized by them. That's how, and, you know, honestly, it really sucks. It really does. But it loses its, I don't want to, it's not that I'm not interested. I am interested in everybody having their murder solved, and especially the two women that are, you know, they're missing to this day. It's not that I'm not interested. It's just, it loses a little bit of my, I'm just not as good as trying to put those types of cases together.
Well, I think the biggest thing is anger is like a really weird commonality to have between even three murders. And this probably is not what people want to hear, but in my mind, I separate out the, like, and this is based on stuff I read and like classes I took and things I've listened to over the years in terms of actual like education down this way. We'll call it criminology because I think that's the best way to describe it. I'm actually like, in my head, I have a very difficult time putting an asshole who's killed three or four people in the same category as a sexual sadist murder. And the reason is the sexual sadist murder, that guy has a plan and a compulsion. And when you have a plan and you have a compulsion, I think it's more terrifying than it is if you've got a guy who just, the way that you've described it, parties. You know, this guy parties with different girls, and every, you know, 15 or 20 people that he parties with, there's a chance that maybe one of them could piss him off when he's done too many drugs or had some crappy time in his life or drank too much or whatever, and somehow they end up in a situation where he kills them, whether it's accidental or on purpose or whatever, and it just becomes sort of a pattern in his life. He's not the same thing as a sexual sadist.
He's not, because it's almost like it lacks the intent. I mean, obviously, if you know, after the first time it happens, he's responsible for his actions, no question. And, you know, there could be some debatable points as to like, well, if you know when you get, you know, you take too many drugs or whatever happens that pushes you to the next level, like you should stop doing that if you're not a killer, right? Which they absolutely are a killer. It's just not the same type of serial killer that I think of when I think of some of the more like Ted Bundy, right? Or Israel Keyes, or people that I have studied a little more intensely. And I found myself realizing, for me personally, when I start putting cases together and it lacks fluidity, right? Usually it's coming from the fact that like there are some things in these cases that make them sort of diametrically opposed to one another. Like they shouldn't be lumped together.
I think where we landed here was I couldn't figure out how this guy, Alex Sesney, is considered to be like a serial killer, but then his name is bandied about over the course of years, like literally years, where they should have found some evidence of that being the case. He falls into the, I would consider him to be a serial rapist who had, like, I'm not letting him off the hook when I say this, because in my mind, they're both terrible things. Serial rapist and serial killer, they're like, that's horrible. It causes tragedy. Both of those situations are bad. But I elevate serial killer slightly because those people lose their lives. I think he's a serial rapist with anger problems. And those anger problems led to the death of Teresa Stone. And they led to the situation where he gets caught and his DNA is able to be linked to Teresa Stone. I don't necessarily think he's a serial killer. Just in the same way that, like, you know, I've called out certain things over the years related to, off the top of my head, Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole. They're not serial killers the way I think of serial killers. Well,
yeah, they're not serial killers at all.
Right. And this becomes a little bit different situation because what's interesting about this is while it's sort of mentioned as it's mentioned in passing related to Alex Sesney, then it sort of gets dropped. People have taken a stab at it, and I cannot cohesively look at this case and go, okay, that's a serial killer. It's very much like the Jeff Davis 8. The thing is, like, it gets the same type of attention as the Jeff Davis 8, but it doesn't get the same level of notoriety. It doesn't rise to, like, the Long Island serial killer level.
I think it's because it's so confusing.
Yeah, it is a very, very confusing case. And the information that they've released about it has been pretty minimal overall. I will say, I want to talk about these cases, and I kind of just want to put them in the order that you would find a timeline on related to the March 1988 to April 1989 New Bedford highway killings, of which available sources say there's potentially an unidentified serial killer responsible for the deaths of at least 9 women and the disappearances of 2 additional women. So the first one on the list is a woman named Robin Rhodes. She is commonly referred to as Bobby Lynn. She was found March 28th of 1989 along Route 140 southbound in Freetown, Massachusetts, by a search dog. It is believed that she went missing in either March or April of 1988. She had a young child, and she had addictions. Her addictions were related to heroin and cocaine. She was not known to be involved in prostitution, but she did know several of the other victims, and she was close friends with one of the other victims who we'll talk about in a moment. The second person who comes up is Rochelle Clifford, and I'm going to say this last name wrong, and I apologize, but it's Dopierala. Dopierala. Now, she was 28 years old, and she went missing from the Falmouth neighborhood sometime, they believe, in late April 1988. Her body ends up being found December 10th, 1988, in a gravel pit along Reed Road. She was in this little tree grove off of the gravel pit. She was about 2 miles from Interstate 195, and she was found by some people that were just riding ATVs in the area. She was partially clothed, and she was beaten to death. There are charges brought in her case for a couple of different reasons. They don't bear fruit, and we're going to talk about that when we get more to the suspect phase here. But Rochelle had testified against a man who had raped her. Now, he is not a suspect in any of this nonsense. She was last seen with an ex-convict who is the boyfriend of another one of these victims, but he is cleared in both cases and he is not a suspect. And that's like sort of the first hint that you've opened up a giant pile of papers and a lot of information that's going to lead to a very, very confusing puzzle picture at the end of all of this. It's like there's so many like weird tangential connections between all these people.
I don't really want to interrupt the timeline, but I'm curious to know, have you seen how the clearing occurred? I've only seen it stated that they were cleared, and I'm not saying that that's not good enough, right? I'm just saying it would be nice to have some information, but I don't want to interrupt the timeline. So
no, it's fine. Just bring that back up here in a minute because it's important. The third person on this list is actually a woman from Newport, Rhode Island. She was 25 years old. Her name is Deborah Lynn McConnell. And I noticed, I don't know if you saw, her case is spelled a couple of different ways. I mean, her name is spelled a couple of different ways, like Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H. And her last name, like the numbers of N's and L's change depending on the report. So Deborah Lynn McConnell, she was a mother to one little girl. She was last seen in May of 1988. So we've got March, April, May, 1988. She had gone to a cemetery for her mother's burial. And her dad was the last person to see her alive. She's believed to have been the third victim. Her body ends up being found December 1st of 1988, also off of Route 140, northbound, though, on the other side in Freetown. She's also found through a cadaver dog search. So Robin Rhodes and Deborah McConnell are found in roughly the same area, a couple of months apart.
Do you have information about how she was found?
She was found, they were literally searching for someone else and they found her on the side of the road.
I mean, like,
she was nude, laying in the brush, and she had a bra that was
choking her.
Tightly wound around her neck.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't indicate further, like, she was just nude with a bra around her neck. And that information comes from a book called The Killing Season, which is, it's a 1994 book about this case. It's called The Killing Season, the unsolved case of New England's deadliest serial killer. A guy named Carlton Smith wrote that one. So he's the one who has that citation in there. And it looked like it came from a good source, but didn't follow up much on her.
No, yeah, I am aware that one of the victims was found like that. I just wasn't sure which one.
Yeah, so that's going to be Deborah Lynn McConnell. And she's actually from Rhode Island, which is another sort of anomaly in all of this. The fourth victim is another Deborah, but it's D-E-B-R-A, Medeiros. Now, she's 30 years old. She was from Fall River, and she lived with her mom. Now, Deborah was known to police. She had a relationship with the local police. But everything that her family and the police knew about her was revealed to be substance abuse related, not prostitution related. So it doesn't mean there's nothing there. It just means like she doesn't have a record or an arrest for prostitution in here. She gets reported missing on May 27th of 1988 after having a fight with her boyfriend in New Bedford. And that's sort of the place that this all occurs. So that's her direct connection to New Bedford is her boyfriend lives there. She was the first of the bodies found. So she ends up being identified in December of 1988, but her body had been found July 3rd, 1988, by a woman who stopped on the side of the road on Interstate 140 in Freetown, who had stopped to get out and go to the bathroom. So when this woman goes to the bathroom, she finds a body in the bushes, basically. Her remains were severely decomposed. Her body was positioned on her back. Her feet were pointed up towards the highway, and her cause of death was strangulation. And again, she had a bra around her neck, but she was partially clothed. Now, with Carlton Smith, he states that the boyfriend was not considered a suspect. And that is the only place that I see this piece of information. I didn't see it related to Deborah anywhere else that I looked. After her death, her mother started counseling addicts sort of as a way to honor the loss of Deborah Medeiros. And as stated, they had lived together. Even though she was 30 years old, she was living with her mom. The fifth victim is a girl. And I say this because she's really little and she's only 19 years old. She's one of those that has like an open range on her missing persons case. She's a couple things that are different here. But the first thing is she was 5'3", although I've seen it as small as 5'1" and as tall as 5'5". Her weight was listed as 100 to 110 pounds. So she's little. And this is Christina Monteiro. So even though she's only 19, Christina had a child. She was last seen in May of 1988. Now, she had a known substance abuse history, and she was an African-American female. She had multiple tattoos of initials and words on her arms. She was last seen wearing a pair of blue jeans and sneakers, and it just says a shirt. So I don't even know why I went with that. But she had brown hair, brown eyes, and she had scars on both of her wrists, and she had a scar near her left eye. The interesting thing about Christina being 19, she's the youngest victim. She is also, from what I can tell, the only African-American victim that's linked to this, and she's still missing. The sixth victim is Marilyn Cardoza Roberts. Now, she was 34 years old. She was actually last seen in April of 1988. She had a close-knit family who she kept in contact with. They believed that she had moved to California to live with a relative. She had some conflicting stuff going on here. Even though she was last seen in April of 1988, I noticed that in Carlton Smith's book, he says she was last seen in June of 1988. What I know for sure is she was not reported missing until December of 1988. And to me, it looks like she's reported missing because the other bodies are being found. And I think it was a situation where when the other bodies were found, family members read about it and went, well, has anybody talked to Marilyn? Now, she was neighbors with Christina. So Marilyn and the youngest girl, Christina, they were neighbors. They're also both still missing. So they are, even though they're like number five and six on sort of the rundown of the cases, and there's some conflicting information related to when Marilyn was last seen, Marilyn and Christina lived close to each other, and they're the only ones who are still missing to this day. Number seven is Nancy Lee Paiva. She was 36 years old, and she was from New Bedford. Nancy had gone to a secretarial school, but she ended up dropping out. When she turned 19, she got married and then got divorced. She had two daughters from that marriage. So when she goes missing when she's 36, her daughters are both teenagers. Nancy was known to be a very supportive mother, and she was already a grandmother at 36, and she was known to be a very loving grandmother. At the time of her death, she was dating someone who was a known drug dealer in the area. She was last seen on July 7th, 1988, walking home from a bar called Whispers Pub after a reported fight with her boyfriend in the South End in the early morning hours. Nancy had reportedly had substance abuse issues, but she was not known to be into prostitution or sex work. Her relationship with her boyfriend had been rocky with multiple domestic violence issues. Now, July 30th of 1988, her nude body was found beside Interstate 195 westbound in Dartmouth by two men who were riding their motorcycles. Her body was found in the same position as Madero's. So that is purportedly the link between them. Madero, while she was found on 140, they make a big deal out of this position being the same position as Nancy Lee Paiva. But the other body that was found off of 195 would have been Rochelle Dopierala. Now, the two of them don't have any other links, but she's found on her back with her feet pointing towards the highway, which to me, I didn't find that as significant as like they make a big link between these cases. I did not find it that way.
I don't find that significant either.
I felt like that's how they pushed her off the road and maybe dragged her that direction quickly. And that's why she ends up that way. Nancy's cause of death is also believed to be strangulation. Her drug dealer boyfriend, known to police at the time, is not a suspect in her death. And that is cited in a couple of different sources, Carlton Smith being the main one, but he's not considered to be, even though they have a domestic violence thing going on, he is not considered to be a suspect or a person of interest. I got the impression maybe he was in jail shortly after all this happened and they would have like picked up on it. I don't think it's like he's in, because supposedly they have a fight on July 7th. I think he goes to jail for something else shortly after that, and there's no way for him to have, like, dumped the body. I think that's the idea. I don't know that 100%. I'm kind of I'm tying some pieces together that may or may not be tieable. So the next victim is a 35-year-old mother of three named Deborah Greenlaw DeMello. So she had a 15-year-old daughter at the time that she goes missing, and she has two boys who are 8 and 3. Her brother, Wayne, he says that Deborah had substance abuse issues and that she had walked away from a prison work release program to which she had been sentenced due to a prostitution charge on June the 18th of 1988. So she's last seen in New Bedford, July 11th, 1988. Her body ends up found off the eastbound Reed Road ramp. So the Reed Road ramp is becoming a common. This is over by the gravel pit. She's found off of the Reed Road ramp of Interstate 195 by a state highway maintenance crew on November 8th, 1988. Her body is nude, and she's in this area that has like the tree grove that I described next to the gravel pit, and her clothing is hanging from like different branches, like on the ground and right above. So she's found there, and some of the clothing around her turns out to be from Nancy Paiva. So Nancy Paiva is the one who was found off of 195 with her feet in a weird direction. Now we've got Deborah DeMello found with some of Nancy Paiva's belongings. So the next victim, number 9, is Mary Rose Santos. She is a 26-year-old mother of two who lives in New Bedford. She gets dropped off on July 16th, 1988 by her husband, who some reports say they were getting back together. I don't know if it's like from a divorce or a separation or what, but she was dropped off near the downtown bus station in New Bedford, and she was seen dancing 5 hours later at the old quarterdeck lounge. Her friend said that her husband had no idea that she had been engaging in sex work to help pay the bills, but she was known to have a substance abuse issue. Her nude body is found March 31st, 1989, along Route 88 in Westport. So basically, 9 months later, she is found elsewhere. There is a beer bottle at the scene. And she has a link to one of the suspects, and we'll bring that up here in a minute. Number 10 is Sandra Botello. She's 24. She was the mother of two young sons, 4 and 6 years old. Botello definitely was a sex worker, and she was known to have a significant substance abuse issue. Although in the scope of all of this, I don't know what they mean by a significant substance abuse issue. I just know that like her name is the only one who comes up as being like I assume she's been arrested for it and potentially gone to rehab for it, and it didn't rehab didn't work, so here she is again. She left her apartment on August 11th of 1988 at 11 p.m., and she never returned. She's the last body found. She was located in the woods along Interstate 195 in Marion, and she's found on April 24th of 1989. Her body was nude, and reportedly she was folded into a fetal position, which is on your side, kind of folded up like you're tucking your knees to your chest. Number 11 is Dawn Mendez. She's 25 years old, and she was last seen in New Bedford on September the 4th, 1988. She was walking from her apartment to a family gathering. So she's a single mom of a five-year-old boy at the time, and she had nine siblings. She had a history of sex work, and she had a history of drug use. Her body ends up being found November 29, 1988, on the westbound Reed Road ramp off of Interstate 195. So she's found by a search dog, and she's mostly skeletal remains, but they were able to pull a fingerprint. So she is one of the first bodies that are identified because of the fingerprint. Okay, so that's our 11 people that we're looking at. And you know, there's definitely some stuff linking a few of these cases. Do you think this is like an outright serial killer, or maybe like a couple of like asshole murderers operating?
I think it could be a combination of, I'm not entirely certain there's a serial killer to how I would describe a serial killer involved, but there's definitely some assholes involved. But there may be, maybe there is, you know, something more to it. But from what I've heard so far, well, I'm curious to know, like, do you see a link that makes you go, oh, serial killer?
I have trouble looking at this as one killer. Like, that's the thing that I keep coming back to here is, and once we start talking about the suspects, it'll become a little easier to talk about this part. But there's like some links between them all. But again, as I said, this is a pretty small area. Like the area itself.
Certainly a lot of women to be missing and killed. And, you know, the two that remain missing, it certainly is, like, as far as statistically speaking, it shouldn't be this way, right? Like it shouldn't be this many women during this period of time.
Yeah. I live in a county. I'm just going to say county because it's multiple cities, but my county has about double the number of people that are in just New Bedford. I don't know everyone in my county, but I know a lot of people, and I know that it feels population-wise big enough that like these people could be linked in some ways because these links are super tangential in some instances, and some of them are more specific. You know, when they start ruling out the people closest to them, I don't know that you ever get to, there is definitely a New Bedford Highway serial killer. I think it's more like there's a couple of like ne'er-do-wells wandering around in this time. But I do think that how quickly it's happening, because basically all of these women go missing, are murdered, and are found, except for the two missing still. The other nine, they're all found pretty quickly. Like this all happens. If we were at the outset to say 24 months, it's not even 24 months. It's not even 2 years that all of this happens. I think that's what makes them think it's one person or two people or whatever.
It is really quick. In fact, it's a little bit misleading, but it's not wrong. It's just most of the women went missing in 88, and it, like, the bodies being found is what spans into 89. Nobody from this group was reported missing in 89.
Right. I'm saying nine murders in 2 years is a lot, but if we keep narrowing that window, like you just said, like that's even more, like that's, I think that's what makes people think like there's one person
Right. Whatever. No, I agree. And it makes sense, except when you then see that you've got you know, a March and an April, and then you've got May, right? Yeah. And then April, and then so to me, it's almost like two different situations because you've got like specific times, and the other thing is they're also they're not well. Some of them are specific. Some of them were specifically reported missing on a day. Some of them are more like they were last seen sometime, right, in spring or whatever, right? It's less specific. And that can make it more difficult. But I think we have definitely, I would say, at least two different groups that I can immediately pull out and say, like, spring and summer, right?
Yeah.
I feel like, and that is a good example of, like, we have spring missings and we have summer missings. And, you know, if there was something to differentiate them in that, like, they weren't killed by the same person, I think by lumping them all together, we could miss something.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you there. So, all right, just for the sake of like covering this part, this case has one of the strangest international brouhahas that happens with it.
I think that this just adds even more confusion to it.
Well, okay, but I didn't do this. Like, I know this
you
is.
And you should cover it. I'm just going to go ahead and say I think that this is a fork in the road that is unnecessary. And it makes me wonder. It could be me. I could be the one that's not getting what's going on here. But it seems to me like. This is a real stretch and it's weird, but go ahead.
Okay. So they have a series of suspects. Like every case, like this is what makes me think this is not a serial killer. Because when I look at certain cases, I can sort of tell what has happened. Like I can look at it and go, okay, well, that guy's responsible for those two things. That guy's responsible for those three things. This case takes this hard right at one point in the early 90s. So somehow, in March of 1993, two detectives from Portugal, basically Fink FBI in Portugal, they come over to New Bedford and they have like a task force meeting on these New Bedford highway killings. What prompts this? I don't know. We found out kind of later. But the U.S. sends two FBI agents over to Lisbon. So they're following this bizarre hypothesis that there are crimes on both sides of the Atlantic that could have been committed by the same individual. Now, if you listen to the names as I was sort of rolling along there, there are Medeiros, Monteiro, Cardoza Roberts, Paiva, DeMello, Santos, Botello, Mendez, Dopierola. So those names could be from a lot of different places. And in New Bedford, they had a sizable Portuguese community. The theory is that because many of the victims were of or potentially of Portuguese ancestry, they thought that maybe these crimes are linked. What they're investigating is actually an unidentified serial killer from 1992 and 1993 who purportedly murdered three prostitutes in Lisbon, Portugal. So as confusing as this is going to sound, I'm going to bring it up because it comes up in this case, and we'll talk about whether we think it has anything to do with this. The first victim over in Portugal is a 22-year-old girl named Maria Valentina. Her nickname was Tina. And she frequented an area that was identified as basically, you know, being a busy area in Lisbon and where potentially prostitutes could be found. That's as far as I'm going to take that. But she ends up found on July 31st, 1992, in a cabin in Santo Adnau, which is like a little, I assume it's a vacation place, but I could be completely wrong. And it could just be like a homeless encampment, for all I know. She was lying in a pool of her own blood. She had been strangled. She had been disemboweled. And some of her internal organs had been removed. So that's our first person. The second victim is a 24-year-old woman named Maria Fernanda. She was found on January 27th of 1993 in a large cabin and this was in they say cabin, but this place is called Between the Fields. Entre Campos is literally between Campo Grande, which is large field, and Campo Pequeño, which is small field. There's a monument here. There's three major roads in this area. This is where the metro station comes through and the railway station comes through. So it's not, I don't want people to picture the wilderness because that's not really what's happening here. But there were people working on a nearby railway bridge and they discovered her body. She was also disemboweled and some of her internal organs had been removed. And there's multiple sources of this from the actual police files. I may figure out a place they're commonly used and drop that in the show notes if you want to read more about this particular killer. The third and the last victim was 27-year-old Maria Joao. She was a resident of the Santa Antonio dos Caballeros ghetto. She lived alone, and she was found on March 15th, 1993, and she was near where Tina Valentina's body had been found. And she knew Tina Valentina. Like the previous victim, she was disemboweled. But this time, almost all of her organs had been removed. Okay, so I got through that part. All of the victims were young brunettes who were alleged to be sex workers and potentially had drug addictions. Like, that's the allegations. They had all been disemboweled with a sharp object that was not a knife. And they were all named Maria. So there's that.
Are you seeing the connection?
To what? To the New Bedford stuff?
Well, that's why it's come up. Because it was brought up to be investigated as if this were the same person.
So, all right, let me just say this. These are serial killings. These three. Are they related to what happened in New Bedford? I mean, well, let's start off with, we have a Mary, a Marilyn, that's it. Then we have a Deborah, a Christina, another Deborah. No, I mean, do you think it's happenstance they picked three young women in the same rough age range named Maria, who are all brunette?
Well, I would have to look into the culture a little bit more, but it would depend on what the statistical probability of girls of that age having the first name Maria would be.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people have the name Maria I'm just not familiar with how popular that name would be. I have no idea if it has anything to do with the case or not. But I do know that this is one of this was in Portugal. And this is one of those cases that it solved, but not adjudicated.
Yeah, so we'll go into that part. The way this all goes down is when the local police department gets a call about the first murder, basically the FBI shows up on the scene. They're not called the FBI. They're actually called the PGA in Portugal. These are the judicial police that we referenced. They all arrive at the scene, and they're shocked at the brutality of Maria Tina Valentina's murder. So medical examiner gets the body and he says he's never seen anything like this. He's been doing this for over 30 years and he doesn't know what's going on here. In the subsequent investigation, it's revealed that the victim is thought to either have been a sex worker or a drug addict or both. And then they find her name, which is Tina, and they figure out that it's, Maria Valentina. So all through 1992, they get tips about this murder. And every one of the tips they get, phone calls, letters, they investigate it, but nothing turns out to give them any idea what has happened to Tina. On January 27th of the following year, when he attacks again, and they're calling him the Ripper at this point, they mobilize a large number of police and a task force. Everybody believes that the perpetrator is the same, and the body has basically been shredded. Like, so when you picture this, if you're going to be picturing this, this is not like somebody's been stabbed or somebody's been cut with a knife. This is either like glass or a scalpel has been used to like open up a human body. And again, her organs are removed and she's in the same general area as Tina. This is with Maria. I'm just differentiating. They're all named Maria. So this time the killer had cut off her breasts, and that was a little different. And the PJ, when they go digging, they discover that Maria seems to be a sex worker. Okay, so they open up this case and they start working it. They start working the case as a national case or an FBI type case with the PJs after Maria Fernandez, the second victim's death. But they include Tina and Maria. Those are the only two victims they have at the time. And they start investigating their past. So they have six men working 24 hours a day on this case. And they even give them people from the very, very busy drug trafficking unit, or what would be the DEA there. So they're pulling in employees from like other agencies just to assist with how heavy an investigation they're trying to get into with this. There were multiple clues about people in the past that could potentially have been violent enough to do this to these women, but they never come up with enough evidence to arrest them. And for the most part, they don't even end up interviewing that many people. But the PJ knew that if this is a serial killer or killers, that they would murder again. So they don't have enough evidence to charge anyone. And on March 15th, the third victim happens. Now, this Maria is mutilated the same way, but all of her organs go with her. She has the same type of general background as the others, and they have no evidence at the scene other than the victims, like blood, etc. There's no hair, there's no fingerprints, there's no footprints, there's no gloves, there's no anything, no fibers. Police had multiple suspects, but again, no evidence. The coroner gets in on this, and he helps with the profile for the PJs, saying that this is a single person, meaning only one killer. He's not related to any of his victims, and he believes he's in a position of power or most likely above suspicion. The coroner makes a comment at one point that these crimes are almost perfect, leaving no clues to any potential suspect. The way that he was grabbing these girls, he was probably knocking them unconscious with a strong blow to the head. He was plucking out their heart, their liver, and their lungs, and he was staying with the bodies for a period of time, but still leaving no evidence behind. He kept his victims' faces intact, never even like cleaning them up or anything. They stayed exactly as he left them. He didn't mutilate their faces. He mutilated their body to take their organs. The three crimes were all probably committed at night, and it was believed they were being committed right at dawn when there would be very few people. This does sort of end up being solved, I guess we could say. I go with what you said earlier. People know who did this, or they believe they know who did this, but it's a really weird story of how they get there. There were two other potential sex workers found dead in the same region. And between 1993 and 1997, there were four similar murders in the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, Denmark, and Belgium. So authorities had developed a theory at one point that the Ripper could be a long-haul truck driver, but none of these other murders were solved. So that remains to be just speculation. And again, if you get into the material in the Lisbon Ripper, they point out that like there was potentially a serial killer active in New Bedford previous to this, and that they had, the FBI and the PJs had compared notes of, you know, reports and photos of the crime scenes because they believed there was potentially a connection. That gets dropped like a hot potato. On November 30th, 2011, which is 19 years after these murders, there's a suspect, Jose Pedro Guedes, who is 46 years old, whose son, Joel, 21 at the time, applies to appear on a reality television show in Portugal called Secret Story. On the show, contestants are kept locked away for 10 weeks in a house, and each contestant has to conceal a secret which everyone else has to try and discover. So the secret that Joel applied with was, I am the son of the Lisbon Ripper. So this information gets turned over to the PJs. And before his arrest, Jose Guedes confessed details of the murders to an online edition of a newspaper called Sol, S-O-L. So he ends up not being able to be tried for the Lisbon Ripper murders because under Portugal's statute of limitations, which is the prescriptive period where they could criminally charge him, he basically has waited it out long enough and the statute of limitations has expired. He had been arrested due to his possible connection with a woman named Filipa Ferreira's murder in 2000 in another area of Portugal known as Aveiro. So they did a comparison between the suspect's version of the facts and the evidence found at the crime scenes. And at the time, it was believed that Jose Guedes could not be the Lisbon Ripper. So basically, his confession did not match the Lisbon Ripper case. Apparently, the PJs had held back the information that there was a palm print that had been left on a carton of milk by the Lisbon Ripper, and the prints didn't match. And in Jose Guedes' version of the facts, he said he didn't own a car, but he used to hitchhike to Lisbon with friends, returning by bus at 12:45 in the morning. However, there was a sex worker who had reported to authorities that she had heard one of the Ripper's victims crying at 1 a.m. So Guedes can't really be tried or convicted of these murders. He was still kept under arrest pending further inquiries into this 2000 murder. But in 2013, Jose Guedes was released due to a lack of evidence. Do you believe that he did it, by the way?
Well, I just want to clarify. In 2013, he was actually tried and found not, I think they call it not proven guilty. So he wasn't just let go. Like, they actually went through the process. And so,
oh, okay. Well, I'm going through all these translations is a little crazy for me.
I feel like it goes against my brain's ability to comprehend things when, if somebody confesses, especially considering it's how long, 20 years later. And, you know, like when, like what you said, the police had found a palm print on a carton of milk. And so they're like, well, you can't be the Lisbon Ripper. Because this isn't your palm print. Like, well, maybe it's the palm print who isn't the killer, right?
that's what I thought. I was like, maybe it's discarded is what I thought.
And then like the time, as far as like that small discrepancy in time, I would say that it's not surprising to me. I mean, it is surprising to me that I don't understand what the point of somebody confessing to these would be, except maybe some notoriety. Clearly, he couldn't be prosecuted for it. I think that they were throwing a Hail Mary with the 2013 attempt.
The trial?
Him on something.
Yeah.
And I feel like it actually, like, I don't know that he did that crime. It sounded sort of like a stretch. And I feel like if you've got a confessed murderer who is then acquitted of something, essentially, it undermines the credibility of them having done the initial crime. I think it's very, well, I don't know. I do think he's probably the Lisbon Ripper. I definitely don't think the Lisbon Ripper cases have anything to do with the New Bedford cases, because none of those girls were ripped.
Yeah, it's a very different type of murder when you get into strangulations versus being ripped. It confused me because, in my mind, like, strangulation versus organ removal is not even on the same planet.
It's not. And, like, the differentiation they make between, like, one of them having most of their organs removed and one of them having all of their organs removed, that's not actually a distinction.
No, it's really not.
And so I just see, like, all this stuff that's kind of – and you're right, it is translated. And so who knows what gets lost in translation. The timing doesn't even really add up because we're talking about, like, a five-year difference here. I have no idea why they decided to, like, intermingle these cases. I guess it's better than them not doing anything at all. But for me, the Lisbon Ripper involvement, it just really – threw everything kind of up in the air, because I don't see any relationship to even have started this investigation together. I don't get it. And, you know, perhaps it's me, and
I don't think I can be in charge of this anymore. So here's what I think we have to do. I think the next episode, I have someone up there who would have been in the press at the time that this was all going on. And I think that we're going to have to talk to an expert about this. I think that's the only way, because, like, we haven't even gotten back to Alex Sesney. We're going to have to in order to sort all of this out, because I don't think he's involved in any of this just based on his age, but just to sort out the New Bedford cases and what's happening there, let's bring in somebody who knows way more than we do.
Boggles my mind that this went that far.
Yeah, I was blown away by how far this went. Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabbrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabbrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at TrueCrimeXS@gmail.com, and you can check out our website at www.TrueCrimeXS.com. We'll see you next time.